And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR 8:55 a.m. streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, Anila. How are you?
Hi, Toby. I'm okay. We're actually without Annie this week, so I'm going to try my hardest to fill in for her by providing our weekly weather update, which is obviously why everyone listens to Solidarity Breakfast.
You're on Solidarity Breakfast, of course, 3CR, your community radio.
And yeah, the weather report, it's cold. Is that thorough enough?
The cold snap is here, signifying it's going to get warm soon.
And a classic hopefully Melbourne turn of events, giving us one taste of a day that's nice enough to enjoy and then taking it away immediately. Anyway, on to serious business. So despite the ceasefire in Gaza taking effect on October 11th, Israeli forces have killed at least 3 civilians. Gaza's health ministry has reported that since the ceasefire went into effect, 23 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli attacks and 122 have been wounded.
Yeah. The scary stuff doesn't end there. Dropsite News has a little report about how in the immediate aftermath of the Donald Trump's announcement on Thursday, there was rampant arson attacks by the IDF with... Dropsite News reporting that the destruction of Palestinian structures following the departure of soldiers who had used them as temporary bases has been a hallmark of Israel's approach to Gaza for 2 years. In July, reporter Yuval Abraham collected testimonies from soldiers describing a myriad of arson methods. Quoting one of the soldiers, "Every Arab house we entered had olive oil. We poured the oil on the sofas, on anything flammable in the apartment, and then we ignited it or threw in a smoke grenade. This was common practice."
And I think for me, it makes it abundantly clear that reporting this week from, you know, major news outlets, the Washington Post, you know, even Foreign Policy magazine and things like that have been talking about the success of the ceasefire, and that, you know, does not seem to be the case. It does not seem to have actually protected Palestinians from Israeli violence.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not...
Which could have been predicted, but...
Yeah, and it's not without... Like, if you just listen to what they're saying on Israeli channels, it doesn't take that much investigating to hear what they said. Government Minister Gila Kamliel told their Channel 7 News that we have already completely annihilated 75% of the entire Gaza Strip. There remains 25, which, as you know it too, we are taking over the city of Gaza. There will be nothing left there that would have really... the potential to be habitable. This is what they're saying on their major news channels.
Yeah, and wow.
Since the peace talks, the ceasefire, the whatever you want to call it, there's been almost no reporting of anything like this on our news. I've been keeping up to date with some of the mainstream news, which is nauseating at best, but there's really nothing of this sort of thing. They say... Hamas is not keeping up with their side of the bargains, which we already know is not true because Israel has announced that it will only be letting half of the trucks that it's promised in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been stymieing any of the aid getting in through Rafah crossing and making trucks go to Kerem Shalom to be inspected before entering.
And I think the other thing that's worth pointing out is that obviously violence in Gaza and Israel's violence in the region isn't contained to Gaza. We've seen more violence kind of cropping up in the West Bank, also intensification of bombings in Lebanon. So I think it's, yeah, probably worth pointing out that a lot of mainstream media is trying to, I guess, use the ceasefire as a reason to suggest that violence in the region perpetrated by Israel is over, it's not happening anymore, but in lots of parts of the region, it's actually increasing.
Yeah, with some crazy stories cropping out of the West Bank of settlers stealing children out of their home, and even just 3 hours ago, there was an update of an 11-year-old child being injured and dying from his injuries in the crossfire of an Israeli raid into the West Bank.
Mm, it's just shocking. And, you know, in other imperialist news, we've also had last week, following our Saturday show last week, the announcement of this year's Nobel Peace Prize recipient, Maria Corina Machado from Venezuela, who is the kind of so-called democratic leader in exile. People very understandably, you know, scratching their heads at the idea that a political leader who's aligned herself significantly with the Trump regime has been really supportive of American intervention into Venezuela is being awarded, you know, the highest accolade in peace.
Yeah, especially with those really, did you see those really weird kind of like behind the scenes Nobel Peace Prize where they were saying, oh, we would never give it to Trump, the videos where they were like, we'd never give it to Trump. But then they give it to Machado and then pretty much straight after Trump says, oh, this, they did it for me.
And she dedicated it to him, so he's probably not too far off.
Yeah. I mean, so they're telling you as plain as day, and it's kind of, what's this effect of, you know, it's kind of like playing both games, like, oh, we seem perfectly fine and normal because we're never going to give it to him. But then actually,
as long as you strap, you slap the label democratic on something, it's definitely democratic. But I think on that note, we've got a few headlines out of Venezuela this week. So U.S. intervention in Venezuela has escalated. Another vessel was struck by U.S. forces on Tuesday, marking the fifth strike on an alleged drug trafficking vessel. It's worth pointing out, no evidence has been produced that any of these vessels have any links to drug trafficking. I think it's also worth pointing out that as a result of that lack of evidence, these are essentially extrajudicial executions of random civilians, which is pretty concerning. And the Pentagon has announced that Admiral Alvin Hosley, who's the head of US or was the head of US Southern Command and the officer overseeing US escalations in the Caribbean, will be stepping down after he raised concerns about the US military mission in the Caribbean. This followed President Donald Trump's authorization earlier this week of the CIA to conduct lethal covert action in Venezuela. So the idea that strikes and military action being taken within Venezuelan land territories is appearing to be more likely than ever.
And I mean, we had the news here recently that off the coast of the Solomon Islands, they found a narcos trafficking sub, and you can see photos of what that looks like. It does not look like any of the footage that gets released from Venezuela, where has 14 crew members on board of some old fishing boat wreck. These are not like, well, we can't say with any
certainty,
yeah. But they did certainly don't look, you know, like drug smuggling vessels.
And the point is, like, you're actually supposed to have a pretty high burden of proof before you murder people.
Yeah.
Like, killing people as a result of alleged crimes usually requires some evidence. But I think for me, one of the most telling things that I've come across this week in terms of the kind of drug trafficking allegations being essentially a pretext for having greater influence over Venezuelan government, particularly in order to capture Venezuelan resources and minerals and things like that, especially oil.
Oil, crazy how that happens.
Yeah, who would have thought? But so this week I came across an interesting bit of reporting that was discussing the fact that, you know, the largest number of overdoses in the US are actually primarily caused by fentanyl, which does not come out of Venezuela or travel through the country on its way to the US. So it's a pretty flimsy pretext at that.
Yeah, and this comes off the back of some of the most crushing sanctions outside of Cuba that the US has placed on Venezuela. There's a report by Vijay Prashad on his tricontinental, I'm trying to think, it's called Global South Insights, and he released, along with the work of a bunch of researchers, a pretty comprehensive dossier talking about how intense the sanctions have been for Venezuela, and how much it is the fact that they've not been allowed a refinery in their country. So they have crude oil, but they actually have no way of refining the crude oil. So
I think this is a really great moment to point out that an exemption was given to, I think it was Chevron, for them to be able to continue. I don't know the technical term for it, but continuing to access and sell oil from Venezuela. So I think, you know, I think the motivations for wanting to get heavily involved in Venezuela are transparently far from being supportive of a democratic regime. And I think that it's probably worth bringing it back to our discussion of Nobel Peace Prize recipient
Machado.
I'm getting her mixed up with Maduro. Their names are too similar. Yeah. So she, you know, is very overtly interested in privatizing Venezuelan natural resources. She has strong ties to the US. She's got a strong relationship, reportedly, with Marco Rubio. She also attended Yale. So it seems, yeah, pretty uncontroversial to suggest that she would be in support of a particularly strong pro-capital, pro-US regime in Venezuela. And as we were talking about off-air, Toby, you know, there's a large grassroots pushback against the Maduro regime. There's a lot of desperation to see an improvement of conditions in Venezuela, economic conditions, and in terms of civil rights and things like that. And the US and Machado are capitalizing off of that desperation to provide a US intervention as an attractive alternative.
Well, she presents the perfect neoliberal fairy tale.
Yeah,
you know,
totally.
The American taught progressive seeming civil liberty,
and she's a woman,
white woman, white presenting woman. Yeah, she's neoliberal wet dream.
So yeah, the idea that she's kind of, you know, the best option for a desperate Venezuelan public, who may or may not need the military support of the US, when clearly her rising to power is going to look like poor and vulnerable Venezuelans being, you know, having less of a safety net, Venezuelan wealth being offshored. It's just absolutely not apparent to the degree that Western media is presenting it that she would be a suitable alternative to anything that is currently going on with Venezuela's government.
And it's funny, like you were saying, it mirrored, like, you know, their names are very similar. It kind of reminds me a bit of the Suharto Sukarno in Indonesia, because this is kind of a similar thing. This is Machado was running on a platform that's dubbed popular capitalism, which is obviously Chilean dictator Pinochet's platform of sweeping neoliberal reforms. And actually, it's to say that, even under such crazy siege like embargoes that Venezuela is, this moment is galvanizing people with massive public support for public defense training and war readiness in case of an invasion. So even people that were maybe Maduro skeptical or didn't like what was happening, or the the economic conditions under Maduro have, like, a lot of people are stepping up mm-hmm. in defense of the country. So, I mean, this to say that we're here reporting to say that there should be no war and we should advocate for no US intervention, especially as we continue to sign on to AUKUS, which mm-hmm. reveals itself more and more as Australia just opening itself up to nuclear waste dumping.
And, you know, sorry to interrupt that beautiful segue. Just before we move on from Venezuela to AUKUS, I'll just mention quickly that it's been pretty well established in multiple studies that sanctions can often actually lead to more fatalities than violent war in some instances. So I think also in the case of Venezuela, talking about having a commitment to peace in that region, I think it's also important to point out that it's incredibly destructive and violent towards especially poor, vulnerable people to have really rigid sanctions on a country to the degree that Venezuela is experiencing sanctions. But anyway, on to AUKUS. I think you were going to make a point about potential costs of waste from AUKUS in Australia.
Yeah, Michael West Media just released, their journalist Rex Patrick just released a really short report after Michael West Media filed a Freedom of Information request about what the cost estimates for a solution for the treatment and storage of high-level radioactive waste from AUKUS would be. This week saw Greens and Liberals vote against Labor's policy to reform the Freedom of Information mm-hmm. Act, which would have seen less access to more sensitive data, but that was thrown out as unconstitutional.
Yeah, worth pointing out here, like, you know, we are the people funding this. We are the people who will be paying for, you know, waste cleanup in the case of AUKUS. So we do have a right to know what we're paying for.
Yeah, absolutely. And the scariest thing is that the Defence Industry Freedom of Information decision maker responded saying that they had sourced only one document that in the section that Michael West Media has highlighted says the conditionally exempted information under Section 47C of the Freedom of Information Act concerns cost estimates for a multi-decade program that are still immature. The information is part of ongoing deliberations that have yet to be finalized or endorsed and thus subject to change. And then in a further section says that there is a strong public interest in not releasing the information.
Okay.
Pretty crazy stuff, yes, to be saying about multi-billion dollar programs.
Yes, crazy. I thought also it would be worth putting some positive news on our agenda.
Much needed.
I'm trying to think if it's too early in the morning to think of words. Put some positive information into your brains. That's what I'm trying to say. So in New South Wales, the Supreme Court has ruled on Thursday that the Labor government in New South Wales proposed anti-protest laws are unconstitutional. Who would have thought? The proposed amendments of the law enforcement powers and Responsibilities Act is what I'm trying to say, 2002, it's not passing the test it's not passing the legal test. Yeah. That amendment would have included the addition of clauses prohibiting protests near places of worship. So obviously impactful on, yeah, weekly Palestinian protests.
Although not weekly anymore. They've been paused in light of the ceasefire being announced. But then tomorrow there is the anti-racist rally.
Okay, good to know. Well, I expect to see some of our listeners there. You heard it here first. So the presiding judge over the case, Justice Anna Mitchell Moore, described the amendments as, quote, impermissibly burdening the implied constitutional freedom of Australians' political expression. So good to see that sometimes legal justice does play out.
And there's a lot, there's a, like, yeah, we say a lot of the doom and gloom, but there is a lot to be hopeful for. We'll hear from Vivian Langford has recorded for us some of the rally speeches from the October the 12th rally in Sydney, and we'll hear from Global Samud Flotilla participant Abu Bakr Rafiq, who was on there giving his recount of what was happening. You can listen to more of Vivian's reporting on the Climate Action Show at 5 p.m. on Mondays, always on 3CR.